It's a bracelet. James rolled his eyes.
Well, I can see that, he replied. But where did you get it?
Well, she said slowly. It's from Atlantis.
What?
James asked. It's from Atlantis, she repeated, and then proceeded to explain how she had come to obtain it. She said that when she was a younger woman, she was diving off the coast of Spain when she heard a voice in her head. The voice was clear and distinct, and actually guided her to a certain location on the ocean floor where the bracelet lay hidden. She followed the directions of the voice and was led directly to the location of the bracelet. Again, James found himself in awe of this mysterious woman. While he wasn't sure what to make of her story, the bracelet was undeniably real. Cleo explained that her life was filled with similar incidents, and that she was closely watched not only by UFO people, but by government people from more than one country. She made enormous sums of money selling her paintings, and used the money to travel across the world, attempting to elude her pursuers. She spent several years living on Indian reservations, but otherwise was constantly on the move. She told James that on one occasion, she was exploring the mountains in Canada when she was guided to a remote area and led to a small cave. She went inside and was amazed to see Egyptian hieroglyphics along the cave walls. She quickly determined that they were authentic. Amazed, she contacted the authorities and told them the location. She returned to the location shortly later and was shocked to find that the entire area had been dynamited. The cave was totally destroyed. James shook his head with disbelief. He was still reeling from the effects of the UFO encounter and the Atlantean bracelet. This was easily the strangest night he had ever experienced. His state of awareness still felt incredibly heightened. As he says, "I was so excited, and so awake. I've never been that awake in my life, that aware, that crystal clear in my consciousness. It was a state of awakeness that I don't think many people ever experience." Then, as they drove around the corner, things suddenly became stranger. By now they were in the center of the Rockies, and the peaks rose overhead around them. Less than a quarter mile away, landed on the nearest peak at eye level, were two glowing saucer-shaped objects. One of the craft glowed a bluish silver, and the other one glowed a bright red.
"Oh, my God, look," James said.
Cleo ignored him, and though she clearly saw the objects, she kept driving. James stared at the objects, trying to make out more detail. Again, they appeared to be featureless, but he thought he could just discern what appeared to be some type of landing gear. The objects remained landed. Cleo kept driving, and after about 1 minute, the UFOs were out of view. James looked at her in amazement, but she kept quiet and continued driving. They climbed down out of the Rockies, checked into a hotel around midnight, and spent the night. The next morning, they continued the drive to Vancouver. The drive took all day and was uneventful. They reached the city just after night fell. However, as they pulled into Vancouver Harbor and approached the Lion's Gate Bridge, Cleo turned to James, pointed up and said, "Do you see that star?"
"Yes," James said.
"That's not a star." James peered up again at the star that wasn't a star. To James, it looked exactly like a star.
"Well, what is it?"
"It's a UFO," she said.
"Okay, Cleo," James said.
"We saw a UFO for real. I believe you. But that is a star."
"No, it's been following us."
"How can it be following us?"
Cleo shrugged.
"Well, it has been." James shook his head.
"Cleo, forget it. It's not a star," she insisted.
"Just keep your eye on it." James did, and about 5 seconds later, the star suddenly moved straight up and then darted away to the west at thousands of miles per hour.
"Oh, my God!"
James screamed out. He turned and looked at Cleo.
"Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I believe you. It's just this is all new for me. I'm such a moron. I'm sorry."
Cleo smiled and patted his hand. They found the hotel where James was staying, and checked in and began the necessary preparations for his performance. He had a month-long booking. He was a huge success and was able to earn enough money to keep a young man happy. He was enjoying his stay in Vancouver, so he remained there for the next month. He kept his same hotel room.
Melanie also decided to stay and was in the room directly below his. Cleo was off doing her own thing, and then one day, she suddenly showed up. To celebrate, they all decided to go out for dinner. James decided to shower first. Afterward, he stepped out onto the balcony to enjoy the view of their boats in the harbor and the beautifully manicured Stanley Park, and to let his hair dry. It was a routine he had quickly adopted after arriving there, and was one of his favorite parts of the day. On this occasion, the sky was gray and overcast. The sun had just set and it was dusk. Looking up, James was shocked to see a group of three or four lights illuminating the cloud layer above him. Says James, they were kind of dancing around. They were soft blue, reddish pink and kind of opalescent. But I could see their movement up through the clouds. James looked down on the ground for searchlights, but there were none. Nor were there any light beams reaching into the sky. What is that? James wondered. As if in response, the lights came swooping down out of the clouds. Says James, all of a sudden, two discs come out of the cloud cover and go whoosh, right in the direction of Stanley Park. They were metal disc-shaped objects. They didn't have any colored lights when they came out of the cloud, but they moved so fast I really couldn't see what color they were. They were metallic, they had that kind of look. James dropped his hair dryer and screamed out, "Oh, my God! Holy shit!" He ran inside, grabbed the phone and dialed Melanie's number. "Did you see that?" he screamed. "Oh, my God, yes!" she cried. "Yes, I was going to call you. Well, come up here and go get Cleo. Okay, I'll be right there." A few minutes later, Melanie rushed in alone. "Did you get a hold of Cleo?" "No," she said, explaining that Cleo wasn't in her room. James and Melanie went back out to the balcony and began reliving the sighting, sharing with each other what they saw. Melanie had also seen the entire incident. Both were amazed that nobody else seemed to see the objects. As they sat there discussing the event, there was a sudden flash of movement in the sky. Their eyes widened in disbelief. Coming out of Stanley Park at treetop level were the two metallic discs. Says James, they came out of the park, but they were low. And when they got over the bay, they went up and into the cloud cover. We saw them go whoosh 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 and they were gone. Melanie and James looked at each other in shock. What was going on and where was Cleo? Moments later, there was a pounding on the door. They ran back inside and opened it. It was Cleo. She was breathless, her hair was disheveled and she was clutching her art supplies. She explained that she had just been in Stanley Park drawing when two discs came swooping out of the sky and hovered right over her. She just had time to grab her things and run scrambling through the bushes back to the hotel. Again, James couldn't help but believe her as he had seen the UFOs himself. He only saw Cleo a few more times after that. The last time he saw her, he called her because his friend had a badly infected abscess tooth. Cleo had talked about psychic healing, so James called her and asked her if she could come over and help. "I'll be right over," she said. She arrived shortly later. She took James's friend into the back room and closed the door. James sat in the living room. Suddenly he noticed an odd green light coming from the slit below the door. A few minutes later, Cleo exited and said, "He's sleeping and he'll be fine." "Sleeping?" James wondered. It was still early evening and they hadn't even had dinner. His friend would never sleep at this time. Cleo must have done something to him. Some moments later, he came out and reported that his abscess tooth was cured. To celebrate, they went out and ordered a steak dinner. After that evening, James never saw Cleo again. "I know she said that the Canadian government watched her closely," says James. "She said, that's why I change hotels all the time. And she said that's why she took refuge with the Indians." While Cleo was undeniably odd, James says that meeting her changed his life. He became increasingly interested in spiritual subjects and began to study the works of the enlightened masters, particularly Saint Germain. He also began to have a series of very personal, highly mystical experiences. Then about 5 years following his UFO experiences with Cleo, he had another UFO encounter. He was on a weekend outing with three other friends on a yacht in the Sacramento Delta. They had finished dinner and were sitting around enjoying a few drinks. One of them asked James to tell the story of his UFO encounter, which James did. His friends began asking questions about the encounter when it happened. Says James, "All of a sudden, we hear this sound. And we look up and there's this bright white and red thing like fire falling from the sky. It was a bright Christmas red, and then it kind of fizzled out. What was that?" somebody asked, and everybody began to chuckle nervously. However, their laughing suddenly stopped when seconds later, another object came out of the sky. This time, it was a vivid pale green color. Again, it came straight down out of the sky above them, as if putting on a display. They all shouted out as the object appeared and then suddenly disappeared. At this point, everybody promptly lost consciousness, literally falling asleep where they sat. Says James, "I can't remember how it happened, but we all fell asleep. I fell asleep next to Jason, pseudonym. The other two guys fell asleep completely. I don't remember falling asleep. Nobody remembers." James isn't sure how long they remained asleep, but it couldn't have been very long. Says James, "We all woke up within seconds of each other, and we all just sort of laughed. We said, 'Oh, we must have been really tired from the dinner.' And we staggered off to bed. We never even talked about it." The next morning, it was as if the incident had never happened. In fact, James never thought about it until years later. Only then did he begin to wonder how he and his three friends all could have fallen asleep, literally on top of each other, in a matter of seconds, immediately after seeing UFOs. Is it possible, he wondered, that they had been taken on board? Since then, James has had other indications of UFO activity. He has had many dreams about UFOs. Says James, "They're all different. But I'm the one who sees them. The UFOs, first. And I'm always the one who keeps everyone from freaking out." One particularly vivid UFO dream involved an amusement park. James was in line to get on a ride called the Tilt-A-Whirl. It was shaped like a disc, and around the inside perimeter of the disc, there were compartments for each person to stand in. Then the disc would spin and tilt upwards, with the centrifugal force keeping everyone pinned to the side. It was a ride James had seen many times. However, in the dream, the ride was actually a flying saucer in disguise, and he was urging everybody to get on board, telling them how much fun it would be, and that they would love it. As soon as everyone, including James, climbed on board, the disc began to spin. It then transformed into a UFO and took off into outer space. At this point, the dream ends. On other occasions, James has woken to find unexplained bruises on his body. He never thought much about them until he recently began reading about UFOs and discovered that mysterious marks on the body can be an indication of unremembered close encounters. As he thought about the possibility that he might be a UFO abductee, James suddenly recalled a strange incident that occurred during his childhood. At the time that it occurred, he had no idea what it meant. Now, he suddenly made the connection. He was 9 years old on his uncle's ranch in Oregon. The area was lush and green, with thick forest and towering green ferns. Shortly after he arrived, James was instructed to never go into the forest alone, that if he did, he would get lost and never find his way out or get eaten by wild animals. James knew what he had to do. The first chance he got, he slipped off into the forest alone and began to explore. James discovered that he loved the wilderness, and he spent many hours exploring around the ranch, finding hidden glens and springs, and other neat spots. One afternoon he was in the forest at least a half mile from the house. He sat on a log playing with a stick when he had the strange sensation that he was being watched. Looking up, he saw two figures standing behind a clump of ferns only a dozen feet away. James quickly averted his gaze. He knew he was not supposed to be out alone in the forest, and he realized that he had just been caught. Then James hesitated. The figures he had seen did not look normal. Mainly it was their complexion, which was a pale ghostly white. They both stood together nearly touching, unmoving and staring directly at James. Also, This was his uncle's farm and it was private property. Nobody else should be there. He looked back up, but the figures were gone. Who was that? He wondered, and seeing nothing, he continued playing. Another incident occurred when he was even younger, which looking back, he wonders if there might be some type of ET connection. When he was around 5 or 6, he had a toy phone which sometimes gave off tones by itself. Even at that age, he knew it was inexplicable, and he never forgot about it. Looking back on his life, James saw that it was filled with unusual and paranormal experiences of many kinds. While his experiences with Cleo occurred in his 20s, he went on to become phenomenally successful, not only as a performer, but later, as a makeup artist in the film industry. Like Cleo, he became very wealthy and often lived out of hotels. In 2011, James Santiago was diagnosed with prostate cancer. Despite treatment, he died within a few months. In 2012, Cleo died of old age. Chapter 8, Examined by Extraterrestrials. Some people who have onboard UFO experiences find that their encounters are shrouded in a powerful amnesia. Many of the people who fall into this category can consciously recall only brief snippets of the onboard segment of their experience. Sometimes, they have to resort to hypnotic regression to overcome the memory blocks apparently set up by the ETs. However, for every rule there are exceptions. In this case, the exception is Teresa Healy, pseudonym. Throughout her life, Teresa has experienced multiple onboard UFO encounters. She has never undergone hypnosis, but still remembers much of what happened. In most ways, her experiences are pretty typical. Her first experience occurred in the early 1950s at age 5 in her childhood home in Illinois. She woke up one evening to a loud buzzing noise filling the room. She then found herself paralyzed. Suddenly, there was a shift and she found herself inside a strange room surrounded by weird beings. She screamed in terror as they tried to examine her physically. After a few moments, she broke the paralysis and woke up in her bedroom. Each experience followed this same pattern. She would wake up in her bedroom to hear a strange noise or buzzing sound. This always signaled the beginning of an abduction. She would then be taken to a strange place that was brightly lit, where strange creatures would examine her. As she grew up, the encounters occurred regularly and rarely varied. Says Teresa, "When I hear this noise, or this sound, I'm paralyzed. I can't scream and I can't move and nothing comes out of my mouth. And then I'm around on this gurney and I see all these dot forms surrounding me. And I'm in a bright light. And I know I'm being observed." Like many abductees, Teresa is unable to recall exactly how she was transported from her bedroom into the UFO, a phenomenon known as doorway amnesia. Once on board, she is undressed, laid out on a table and examined. "It was often a traumatic experience," says Teresa. "I'll put it for you this way, honey. It was not enjoyable. I would not be in my room, but on this gurney, or on this table, like an examining table, being observed by these forms or whatever was around me. And they were talking. I don't know what they were saying. They were talking in a different language. They never talked to me. I could hear them conversing, but I don't know if their lips moved or if I was listening to their mind. I don't know. I saw someone point to me, but I had this big bright light on me, and I couldn't scream or anything. And when they brought something, I don't know if it was an instrument or what it was, but I knew I had to get out of there." Like many people taken on board UFOs, Teresa's ETs appeared to be a version of the commonly described greys, with the typical minor variations. Says Teresa, "They were tall. They were not small. These forms were tall. To me they looked stately. I don't know how to describe it. I didn't see a face. It was something like an oval, but rounder on top, then came down. It was a black form, like a silhouette. They were all around me on this table. It was like I was paralyzed, and I wanted to scream and I couldn't scream." Teresa eventually found that she was able to end the experience by exerting an extremely strong force of willpower. Says Teresa, "It takes everything of my will and I have a very strong will as you know to break it. And then I'm back in my room. It's strange. The experiences usually last about 15 to 20 minutes, though Teresa is not sure about this. As she says, well, when you're paralyzed and you're in that situation, it seems like forever. There is no time. But then when you come back, it's hard to believe the time lapse. I don't know how to explain it. The first few times it happened, Teresa had no idea how to categorize her experiences. She mentioned it to a few people at her church and was shocked by their reaction. They told her that she was being attacked by the devil. She soon learned to keep the encounters secret. Usually the encounters started with her being woken up from a deep sleep. However, on occasion, they would begin when she was awake. Says Teresa, sometimes I'll be awake, and it's the same thing, the same sound. And then I'm paralyzed again. And then I'm being observed. Sometimes she could somehow feel when an encounter was imminent. Says Teresa, I'll get real restless. I would get real restless and I could sense that something was going to happen. And then all of a sudden it would happen. When they first began, she didn't actually associate her encounters with UFOs. As Teresa says, this was even before they talked about flying saucers or UFOs. Then one evening around 1965 or 1966, she was driving with her mother from Illinois to Ohio. It was a moonless night, overcast and drizzling just hard, enough to require the windshield wipers. Teresa was driving and her mother was in the front seat. Suddenly, they both observed a luminous huge thing moving directly toward the car over the road at treetop level. Teresa looked at her mother in shock. It was obviously a UFO craft. Her mother nodded and said, "Yes, I see it." Teresa described the object as being a huge, big, luminous light. It was just eerie looking. As the object hovered directly overhead, both Teresa and her mother felt their hair stand up. Both also experienced sudden splitting headaches. Teresa recognized the headache as the symptom of her many earlier bedroom encounters. Her first impulse was to stop and get out of the car. Her mother, however, became frightened and pleaded with her to drive away. Teresa pressed on the accelerator and left the UFO behind them, still hovering in the air. It was following this incident that Teresa really linked her bedroom experiences with UFOs. It became especially obvious when UFO reports started to occur in her area. Says Teresa, the time that these things would happen was when they would be spotted, or there would be reports of UFOs in the area. It just kept happening and happening and happening. It was always the same thing. I was being observed. Teresa estimates that she's had dozens of encounters, which occur sporadically with no real pattern. As she got older, the experiences slowed down and eventually stopped. Teresa isn't sure if it's because she was so ornery and hostile during the experiences, or if it was because the ETs were no longer interested in the woman in her 60s. She's at a loss to explain why the ETs were interested in her. She's heard about people being operated on, or making hybrid babies for the ETs, but she doesn't believe this has happened to her. Nor has she noticed any unusual scars or marks on her body. She did express some concern when her son told her that he was also having similar bizarre nighttime experiences. However, at this point, he has declined to discuss them in any detail. When asked if the ETs have given her any messages or if the encounters changed her in any way, Teresa apologizes and shakes her head. She has received nothing from the encounters, she says, other than the strength one gains from facing adversity. Her encounters have not been pleasant. On the other hand, neither does she feel unreasonable fear, or that the aliens are evil. She remains very matter-of-fact about what has happened to her. The only conclusion she feels comfortable making about the ETs is, as she says, they are very advanced. Chapter 9, The Bugman in the Spaceship House. Jojo. Jojo. It was a sing-song voice, playfully calling his name in his mind. I was almost 5 years old, standing in front of Foodland, Joe Gardner says. My mother and I were standing in the parking lot, waiting for a cab to take us home. It was 1974. And they were in Huntington, West Virginia. The day was bright and sunny. Joe had brought his little red wagon, and they had planned to walk home. But there were too many bags of groceries, and Joe's mother decided a cab was necessary. Looking up, Joe saw a grayish cylinder high in the sky, rotating end over end, but otherwise stationary. "Mom, what's that up there?" he asked. "What is that?" Joe's mother looked and said, "It's a satellite or something." She seemed unconcerned at the time. Later, she admitted it looked more like a gray disc. To Joe, it looked like an unmarked can of soda pop, metallic silver and glinting in the sun as it whirled in space. When they got into the cab, the object was still overhead, hovering in place. Joe always remembered the sighting, but he never really thought about it. He just kind of filed it in the back of his mind. Some months later, in the summer of 1974, Joe and his family left their home in Huntington and drove west into Kentucky, just a short distance away. They were going to pick blackberries which grew wild along the roads off the main highway. It was something they had done many times before. With Joe was his dad, Joe Sr., and Joe's mom and sister, who was not quite a year older than Joe. "My father would take us for Sunday drives," Joe explains. "We had a black Cadillac, two-door, Eldorado with a moon roof. We were looking for blackberries. We go blackberry picking every late summer. We had a bucket and you could pick berries along the side of the road, before they started spraying pesticides on them and killing them." They drove into Kentucky and pulled onto County Road number 9, which parallels the main highway. They were looking for blackberry bushes when Joe's dad said, "Hey, look at that funny spaceship house." Joe, who sat behind his father, looked to his left and saw what caught his father's attention. It was just off the side of the road, nestled inconspicuously among the trees at the head of a holler. "I looked and glanced at it," Joe says. "It looked like highly polished aluminum. It was more or less like a flattened ovoid shape, but it had a rim around it, and it was sitting on stilts, on legs. It was probably 30 feet in diameter. And it had two little round portals along the bottom." They all looked at it and marveled at how strange it looked. Then they drove on. Although he only saw it for a few seconds, Joe was electrified. Shortly after they passed it, he knew he had to say something to his dad. "It just struck me, that's a once-in-a-lifetime chance right there," so I pleaded with him. "Please, please, please, take us back," Joe said. "I want to see it again. Let's go see the spaceship house. I want to see it. Let's go see the spaceship house." Because of Joe's constant requests, Joe Sr. abruptly pulled a U-turn and drove back to the spaceship house. The structure was about 150 feet off the road, hidden among the trees. There was no driveway, no sidewalk and no electrical wires. Joe Sr. approached first, and Joe Jr. followed. Soon, they stood right beside it, close enough to touch. There were two round windows on the bottom, both round and dark. "This is weird," his father said. "Don't you move. You stay right there." Joe's father began to walk around the object. "We thought it odd that there wasn't a front door," says Joe. "I just thought it was so neat. It was kind of white aluminum. There were no panels on it. It was among the trees in the shade. There were some windows around the bottom, and there were more windows around the upper top. I was too short to look into the windows that were on the top. I stayed where my dad told me. I stood right where I was at, and I put my hand on one of the metal support legs, and I remember it was like touching ice." The more they looked, the more they realized how strange it was. The house was on stilts. It had round windows, and an upper deck that kind of ran around the whole perimeter. "My dad walked around the back to find a door. When he came around the other side, he had the most puzzled look on his face. He stood beside me and he scratched his head. 'Well, that's funny,' he said. 'There's no back door.' He pointed out that there were no power lines and no gas meter. 'This must be one of those new, solar power energy homes. It doesn't have any wires going into it.'" Joe's father banged his fist against the side, making the entire object emit a loud metallic clang. "Hello?" he said. "Hello? Anybody home? Hello?" Joe tried to look into the darkened windows on the bottom of the craft. Suddenly he heard a voice coming from above. It was a strange voice. It sounded old, crackly, and high-pitched. Up here. Up here. Joe looked up and was amazed by what he saw. It was a long skinny kind of grayish arm with three fingers, and they were using the fingers to kind of wave us up.